Welcome to It's About Florida, a weekly discussion program tackling the key issues and topics of interest to our state. I'm Tramell Gomes. Former Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum spearheaded the lawsuit calling the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. The law mandates that every American have health insurance. McCollum says the law oversteps power boundaries, and the argument against the law is a strong one. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in the case in late March, but McCollum says no matter what the final ruling is, it'll have a long-lasting impact. McCollum discusses the current law with our chief legislative news producer, James Paul.
Bill McCollum, former Florida Attorney General, you believe the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional.
That's correct, I do, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about it.
You were joined by 13 other attorney generals in filing a court challenge to the Act's individual mandate, which requires most Americans to have an insurance plan to pay a federal penalty.
We did file that lawsuit. There were 13 of us originally, and the National Federation of Independent Business is a party, and a couple of individuals. That lawsuit was filed in the Northern District of Florida in the Pensacola Division. And Judge Roger Vincent ruled on that several months ago now. The case we prevailed on, the question with regard to the individual mandate being unconstitutional, and it went on to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, where it was heard this past summer. That court also ruled the individual mandate to be unconstitutional. I disagreed a bit with Judge Vincent, who said it wasn't severable, meaning it couldn't be separated and the whole act was thrown out, but they found it was severable. Now it is before the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will actually hear oral arguments on this on the 26th, 27th, and 28th of March in an unprecedented three-day amount of time being devoted to this case. And it isn't just the individual mandate. There's a question of the constitutionality regarding the Medicaid provisions in this law and the coercion of the states, which was another aspect of our lawsuit that has sort of been lost in much of the discussion. And then, of course, this severability question and some questions that have been raised by other courts about whether or not this is a tax or a penalty and the anti-injunction provisions and some technical things apply or not related to timeliness.
The individual mandate is wrapped up in a Commerce Clause argument, but you call the individual mandate to acquire health care insurance, you call it a living tax.
Well, this is a really big issue because somebody here today sitting in front of their television set or their radio listening to this program and doing no commercial activity, not actually engaged in trying to purchase a car or insurance or down at the hospital getting services or anything like that, is being forced or required to buy health insurance or pay a penalty. And this is, in a way, a living tax. It's just a tax on being alive. It's just a tax on being there, was the illustration I was giving. There are many other ways to present it, because when our founding fathers created the Constitution and all the checks and balances, they reserved to the states the police powers, they called it. That's a little bit misleading because it doesn't mean law and order. It just means everything they didn't grant to the federal government the power to do. And they were very explicit in setting out what powers the federal government was to have and that everything else was left to the states. The Commerce Clause was not intended to be all universal everything. There would be no point in having it, the separation of the states and the federal government, if that were the case. And so the Supreme Court has said in case law fairly recently that there are areas beyond which the federal government can't go in trying to regulate these types of things. But this is a defining case. We've never had in the history of the court a decision or a question that's come before them where Congress has attempted to encompass in interstate commerce and its powers a regulation of non-activity, the regulation and the compulsion for somebody to have to do something. Judge Vincent compared it to say, well, why couldn't you just tell people that this is something that you can do, you have the authority to do this, Congress, why can't you tell them they have to buy broccoli and eat it for their health? Because if they don't, they'll hurt everybody else and cost people and so on. Now, the federal government argues it quite differently. The Justice Department tries to make this out as part of a very big health care issue, and it has a huge argument that's going, of course, contrary to what I just said. But I think we have the more persuasive argument. We'll all find out, I suppose, when the court eventually rules.
Yeah, the court, the Justice Department or the Obama administration has argued that health care is part of the interstate commerce system because of the cost shift nature of health care. If someone has a heart attack, usually what is done, the person is rushed to the hospital and is given medical care. And then if they have no health insurance, the rest of the public has to pick up the cost. And that affects insurance rates of everyone. Where is the weakness in that argument?
Well, there's nothing unique about that argument. In other words, cost shifting doesn't just occur in healthcare. It occurs in all kinds of other things. So it's a question of where do you draw the line and say, is there any limit on Congress's power in if you adopt that as a governing principle for constitutional interpretation? For example, if you have a credit card and you are charging things that you can't afford to pay for, eventually the cost of that card and all those charges that have been defaulted on by the credit card company will be passed on to other customers in the form of higher interest payments or in other cost items because they have to recover their money. It's the marketplace at work. And there are many, many other examples of cost shifting that go on that are far in addition to and outside of healthcare. So I don't think that argument flies to make this unique. They're trying to divert attention away from what's really being regulated here, which is insurance. Healthcare is the context in which all this is in, but the bill, the Affordable Care Act, is focused on providing insurance, is focused on covering pre-existing conditions, it's focused on increasing the eligibility for Medicaid recipients, making more people eligible for it, changing the employer base, creating these health insurance exchanges. All of these things are insurance related, albeit health insurance.
Mm-hmm. But it's insurance in the context of health care. I mean, as a society, we don't let people lay on the street and die.
Oh, of course not. Here there are other alternatives. That's one of the other things that I think the court will watch, the Supreme Court listen to and look at. You have other methods of dealing with the same problem that they're dealing with by forcing people to buy insurance. The idea of forcing them to buy insurance would be to lower the cost so that the insurer wouldn't be at as great a risk. More people would share that cost of insurance because you're trying to get more people covered. The idea being you want to pay for the pre-existing condition and so on. There is a concept going around now that's been drafted and may wind up being the alternative to the Affordable Care Act, the substitute, the replacement vehicle, if you will, that involves using refundable tax credits. That would be where the government says, okay, if you pay a certain amount of income taxes every year, then we'll give you a credit for the cost of your insurance premiums, and you individually can go out and buy within the framework of what's offered X amount of insurance, health insurance, to cover you. And if you don't pay any income taxes, then we will pay you anyway the amount of the cost of this policy, and we'll pay for your health insurance. Another way would, of course, have been to have a straight tax. They could have come along and said, instead of doing it this way, they could have just said, okay, we're going to increase the income tax by however much it takes to pay for this. So there's nothing unique about the individual mandate, except that it is violative of the Constitution. It goes further than anything ever has gone in the past. But the point is, it's not essential to achieving the goals that Congress was attempting to achieve. And it is something which violates the basis of our Constitution, which is why I find it, and the states find it, so abominable.
You were quoted in one newspaper article as comparing this case as the most significant case in the past 50 years, except for maybe Brown versus Board of Education, for its impact on a large number of people.
Well, I think it is. It will be one of the most significant cases the court's ever heard, because it is a definitive federalism case. In other words, it is going to define, and it has to by its nature, a brighter line between what the states have the power to do and what the federal government does. Here we have a Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause basically has been interpreted by the court to say federal government, the Congress, can restrict and restrain and regulate interstate commercial activity, whatever that is, and including some cases where it's relatively passive in terms of how it appears to be. But in every case, there's a hook of somebody having engaged in some way in some activity, growing wheat or whatever it was. In this case, if they were to adopt this rule, they would be going beyond that point, and they would be saying, look, you don't have to be engaged in any actual activity. You simply have, by the virtue of not doing something, you're affecting commerce. Now, you are affecting the economy by not doing a lot of things. I mean, if you don't buy products, if you're sitting at home and you have a lot of cash at home and the economy is doing very badly, as it's been recently, and you're not out there spending your money, you're affecting commerce. So the court has the problem, and we as a country do, of how far do you go? There were those who argued back in the 1930s and 40s that there was no limit at all. But clearly, the U.S. Supreme Court since then has said, yes, there have to be boundaries, and they've issued some comparatively narrow cases that have said in these particular areas, you know, Congress can't go that far. This is a broader one. This is a very significant demarking line that will be drawn by the court one way or the other in what could well be a 5-4 decision. We don't know, but it's going to be a close decision in my judgment.
In those previous cases, the court has seemed to rule in favor of this interpretation of the Commerce Clause whenever it was an economic issue, like you mentioned the wheat. A farmer in Ohio, I believe, was prohibited from growing wheat for his own personal use because it would affect commodity prices. It seems that in the four cases that the court has addressed, when it comes down to an economic issue, it upholds the interpretation of the Commerce Clause. Am I right there?
Well, not entirely, because,
okay,
again, there was economic activity. There was something that person was doing. In that case, it was about growing wheat. Whether he sold it on the market or not, he was still growing wheat. In this case that we're dealing with, we're talking about somebody not doing anything. They're not actually going down to the hospital. There have been plenty of examples given of people who never in their lives actually used hospital facilities or engaged in health care for one reason or another. Maybe their lives were shorter. Maybe they were extremely healthy. Maybe whatever reason they didn't go to the doctor. They didn't use the care. So while the majority of people certainly do, there is not necessarily an economic activity here because we're talking generically about the whole country and about everybody. And so this is a much broader case than the case that you cited. And that's why this is fascinating. And there are a number of shades in the other cases they have. But there's no question, anybody you talk to, whether they're the Justice Department or the most liberal professor in a university who wants to uphold the constitutionality of this, they're all going to agree that this is unprecedented. That is, there is no case law that gets to this particular question.
And on the complaint, on the legal suit, your name appears first. You were the first one to sign it. And the New York Times noted that, just like John Hancock.
I didn't remember I was compared to John Hancock. He has a big signature, of course. But I was the one who put together the team. I remember what happened year before last. We had a method of getting together as attorneys general and talking about how we challenged things that were affecting our role or the states that we represented. And there was concern before this law was passed with the Cornhusker kickback, which was a provision that would have exempted the state of Nebraska from having the same burdens as other states would have, like Florida, in the area of Medicare and Medicaid under this law. And we didn't like that idea. And a group had gotten together with the South Carolina Attorney General and said, we're going to challenge that if this becomes law. And then along the way, I'd seen an article in the Wall Street Journal written by David Rivkin, who's a prominent attorney, and he had analyzed the individual mandate. And I told the group, look, if we are going to see this become part of the law, then I think it needs to be challenged as well. And I'll take the lead on this while the South Carolina Attorney General took the lead on the Cornhusker kickback. Well, as it turns out, they took out that Cornhusker kickback after a lot of flack. The individual mandate was passed into law. We had 13 states ready to go. And within literally minutes, less than 10 minutes after the president signed the Affordable Care Act into law, we filed this lawsuit in Pensacola in the Northern District of Florida challenging its constitutionality. So that's how that came about. Now, there are 26 states today that are party to this.
This is It's About Florida. I'm Tramell Gomes. You're listening to an interview with former Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum done by our reporter James Call. McCollum explains how the lawsuit against the Federal Affordable Care Act got started. But what are the key arguments in the case? Let's get back to the interview.
And the lawsuit has 3 points. In addition to the Interstate Commerce Clause, there is the expansion of Medicaid, which you argue is an encroachment on states' rights.
This is a very unique argument to the Florida case, the one we're talking about that got before the Supreme Court. None of the other decisions that you've read about in other states have had this argument in it. We made the argument for a number of reasons, but the principal one is the cost to the state of Florida of the new expanded Medicaid provisions. There is dicta, we call it, that is not a definitive decision, but language written by the majority in a Supreme Court case called Dole, in which they say, look, you can have inducements in bills and legislation that provide opportunities for money to the states to encourage the states to do certain things. If they don't, they don't get the money. But at some point, it can become coercion, and it's against the constitutional provisions of the powers of the separating the powers of the states and the federal government to coerce the states, to actually force them to do something. And we think this rises to that level. First of all, it's a huge amount of money. It's the largest program, the Medicare program of the federal government outside of defense that we have. It's just a very, very big program, and certainly the largest grant program to the states. And there's a provision in the new law, the Affordable Care Act, that for the first time says not only do the states have to pick up a share of the cost of the Medicaid provisions. In Florida, by the way, for the regular Medicaid recipients, it's about 40% of the cost to those who are eligible for that. The federal government, under this new law for quite a few years, will pick up much more than its 60% current share for the newly eligible recipients, for those who are now, by the expansion of 200% of poverty level, for the first time made eligible. For anybody who perhaps had not actually signed up for Medicaid but was eligible before the law passed, the states still have to pick up that 40%, which is a huge amount of money. And we think more will because of the individual mandate. But beyond that, there's a provision in this law that says for the first time that the states are required to provide the necessary doctors and hospitals and healthcare providers to care for all the Medicaid-eligible recipients, which means that if the state doesn't have enough doctors, for example, or enough hospital beds, then they've got to provide them or they're going to wind up probably with private lawsuits that are could be very expensive for the state. So that's one element of additional cost. There are two in that I just described. And then the third one that most recently we've had a discussion about this in part of this argument and will be part of it before the Supreme Court has to do with the fact that if there is somebody who is eligible for Medicaid, there is a provision that says the states have to pick up a larger percentage of the subsidy for the insurance cost of Medicaid, and they figure out what that is, which is a little over $12,000 a year, something like that, for a family of four. And if that's the case, the reason the states would have to pick up a larger share is because we have mandates, not the individual mandate, but mandates in our law requiring certain coverages in every basic health insurance policy. There are about 50 or 60 of those in Florida right now. And in the federal government program, they haven't come down with it yet, but they will provide a basic number, maybe it's 10, 12, 15, I don't know how many, but a certain number of required mandated coverage items that have to be covered in a basic policy. And if the states exceed that, which of course all the states do, and certainly Florida does, then that's going to cause a pro rata increase in the amount of the shared cost that the state is going to have to pay, in essence, to the federal government to pay for the subsidy, if you will, for all these Medicaid recipients. And that's billions of dollars. So while it's a little complex argument, and that's why you probably haven't read as much about it, it's a very serious argument. It's a very expensive argument. And the states are being, in our judgment, coerced to do this in violation of the Constitution.
Okay. Well currently, Medicaid consumes about a quarter of the state budget. And the state estimates that under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that by 2019, the act would add an additional $1 billion to the Medicaid budget. But for the first 3 years of the act, the federal government would pick up 90% of the cost.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to a minute ago in that long answer, perhaps longer than I should have given you.
That seems to be a savings to the state. I mean, currently we're paying about 40%. The state payment would drop down to about 10%.
Of the newly eligible people, of those who weren't eligible at the time this law passed because the eligibility had been expanded so greatly, so many more people will be eligible. And that's the kicker in here because there'll be a lot of people who are already eligible but had not actually applied for Medicaid that because of the way this is structured are going to come forward to get insurance. They're not going to go out and pay the premium for an insurance policy, the individual mandate. If they're eligible for Medicaid, they're going to go take advantage of it in order to be able to show that they don't have to pay the penalty. And then in addition to that, the other factors I described to you, the cost factor that is there because the state is being forced to provide doctors and hospital beds and so on. That wasn't in the law before. It was just a total dollar question, not a question of having to provide the actual numbers of doctors and hospital beds necessary, or nursing home beds for that matter. And the last one I mentioned to you, which is a little complicated but nonetheless very multi-billion dollar expensive thing our state insurance department has analyzed for the legislature recently, is a hidden cost of several billion dollars a year potentially to the state. And all of that's going to crowd out other things you could be spending money for in the state, for education, for taking care of those children that we are supposed to take care of and so on.
So theoretically, this act could force the state to build more hospitals.
Theoretically, that's right.
Theoretically.
And that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Or force them to, force them to make them available and subsidize them if necessary. I think it's much more sweeping and broad than people realize. And then you haven't asked me about this severability much, but that's a really key thing too. If they find either one of these, the Medicaid issue or the issue with the guardian individual mandate unconstitutional, the Supreme Court will have to decide whether the whole law comes down or only part of it. And surely if they find the individual mandate unconstitutional, since it's so interwoven with all these other insurance provisions, including the pre-existing condition provisions that require coverage of that by insurers, then the many parts of this law that are insurance, directly insurance provisions, I think that they will have to, at the very least, rule that those are also unconstitutional or throw them out. Because the law doesn't work otherwise. That will they throw the whole law out? Well, technically, I think they should, but they may or may not. But there's a lot to be debated on that. This is why they're taking 3 days of oral arguments on this, which they just don't do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's unheard of.
Now, the Affordable Care Act would go into effect in 2014, and it would provide Medicaid coverage for anyone earning less than 133% of the federal poverty line, which is $29,000 for a family of four. And that would bring in about 1.3 million Floridians, or 1.3 million people, into the state Medicaid program. Now, the third part of your lawsuit concerns the tax penalty for no insurance. You argue that this is an illegal direct tax, that if someone who can afford it, does not go out and purchase health insurance, then they have to pay a federal penalty. The IRS would add it to their tax bill.
Well, I don't argue, or we don't argue, that it is a tax. We argue that it's not a tax at all. It's a penalty that's collected by the IRS. And Congress is pretty explicit about that this comes under the Commerce Clause. There are lots of other penalties that are collected by the Internal Revenue Service that aren't taxes. But for those who argue, and there are a couple of courts who concluded this in other states, not in ours, that this is actually a tax, we would say, well, if you do consider it a tax, it's not appropriate. It can't be done this way because it is a direct tax. It is not an income tax, which has been passed specially. It's not a tax that there's an authority to do unless you do it in a way that's apportioned a certain way under the Constitution that, by the way, in our history has never been done. You could do it, but you've got to go through certain steps to do it. In dealing with each state, et cetera, a very complex formula would have to be crafted. Congress didn't try to do that because Congress didn't consider this to be a tax. Very on its face, I mean, in their history and in all the debate that went on, they went out of their way to say this is not a tax. So, a couple of courts have found this to be a tax? And the reason why that's important, by the way, is more goes to the question of timing. If it is considered to be a tax rather than a penalty, then there is a question as to whether or not the case is ripe for going up, because there's what's called the anti-injunction law, and that says in tax cases, until somebody is liable for the tax, there can't be any lawsuit, there can't be any constitutional challenge. So it would postpone the day of reckoning. It would not end the debate. It would just allow the courts to push it off for a couple of years until this law becomes, the individual mandate kicks in and the taxes or the penalties become collectible.
Out of the 3 points that you argue in your case, which one do you think is the strongest?
Well, I think the individual mandate is clearly considered to be the strongest. We've always thought that it was. But it's hard for me to distinguish that the Medicaid provision is weaker. It's been arguably weaker only because the lower courts have not sustained it in the two cases we've had. So you'd have to say, well, it's weaker in that sense. But from the perspective of looking at this and saying which one of these is stronger in terms of a better constitutional founding, I think that they're both strong arguments. They're both in areas that are somewhat novel. The individual mandate is concerning passive, no activity. I'm not doing it, but sitting and watching my TV or listening to my radio, and you're going to force me to buy a product or pay a penalty. And there's just no history of that, Congress having that power under the Constitution. And then over in the Medicaid area, you've got the court not having any decision, but having only what we call dicta, saying there's some point beyond which the federal government can't coerce the states anymore. They can't take the money that they put out and put on the plate and say, hey, take this program, share in the cost, make this agreement with us, and then if at some point put provisions in it that are onerous to the degree that this is. And this is an exceptional. I can't imagine any program, certainly not any grant program of the federal government, that would be any bigger. And they did talk about size in that dicta, how big it would be and how onerous it could be. It could be, if it's certain size, then it would be an unburdensome thing for the states. So I think both are very strong arguments. The severability argument is, of course, a contingent argument. It's based upon the assumption one of these other two is going to be upheld by the court, and they will find that provision unconstitutional. And then do we take the whole thing down or not? We think that's a strong argument when we get there, but it's not the heart of the case as these other two are.
But whether or not Congress can regulate inactivity, what an interesting sentence, isn't that? Regulate inactivity.
It is. It's a challenging sentence to say. Again, it would be precedent, historical, everything else precedent setting for them to uphold this. But there's a reasonable chance they will. I don't think you can predict how this court's going to rule. I personally think that Justice Kennedy is going to make that decision because the court's most likely to break 4-4 otherwise. But one can't be completely sure of that. A Democrat-appointed judge on the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals voted to make a majority vote that this individual mandate was unconstitutional. A lot of people before that judge heard that and made that case decision assumed that she was going to vote the other way just because that would have been the precedent for her past history. So we can't be 100% sure how the Supreme Court's going to vote, but it's going to be a very, very significant case. As you said at the beginning, I think this will be one of the most significant cases in this century and in the past 100 years. I shouldn't say in this century because we just started it, but in the past 100 years at least.
You didn't see the John Hancock quote or mention in the New York Times article?
I must have missed it. But I'm flattered they would think that was significant enough to be there. Listen, there's nothing as significant as being the signer of either the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. But on the scale of court cases and on the scale of those kinds of filings that lead to historic cases, I'm quite confident that my signature will have been on one of those that will be remembered for a long time to come. Whether I will be or not, the case certainly will be.
Former Attorney General Bill McCollum, thank you so much for your time, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you to our guests, former Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum and our Chief Legislative News Producer James Call. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Our senior producer is Regan McCarthy with technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. Please join us again next week for more discussions about the issues impacting our state. I'm Tramell Gomes.